Welcome to the Israel Conversation by the Masa Leadership and Impact Center. We are informally debating issues that concern Zionists about life, culture, and politics in Israel.
Hello, everyone. My name is Kalev Ben-Dor, and for today's podcast, I'm very, very happy to be joined by Matthew and Mike. How are you both doing?
Okay. Did you say podcast?
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway.
I just think I pronounced it the correct way.
As always, it's a pleasure to join you, Kalev.
Thank you very much. Interesting beginning. Anyway, today we are going to be discussing quite, you wouldn't know it from the beginning, but we're going to be discussing a very important topic relating to Israel's war against Hamas. And it relates to a whole array of humanitarian issues, whether that be civilian casualties, collateral damage, humanitarian aid that Israel has been allowing in and sending into Gaza, even when it knows that a large proportion of that is going to be stolen by Hamas. And also the issue of proportionality. I think what's interesting with proportionality is that most people's natural understanding of proportionality actually relates to this amazing scene, again, from those of a particular generation or inclination. I don't know if you've seen The West Wing. If you haven't, you absolutely should. And there is one episode which is called a proportional response or a disproportional response?
I think it was a proportional response.
Proportional response.
I think.
And they're discussing They're discussing America responding to an attack that was carried out from Syria. And the generals will add it in, maybe even in the intro, will add it in so people can hear what's going on. And they're referring to a whole bunch of different options. And at a certain stage, the president says, what is the benefit of a proportional response? Maybe we'll even play it now.
Morning, Mr. President.
What do we got?
Three retaliatory strike scenarios.
When are they operational?
At the president's command.
No prep time.
We're there.
All three scenarios are comprehensive, meet the obligations of proportional response, and pose minimum risk to American personnel and assets. Scenario one, or Pericles one, to use its code name, sir.
What is the virtue of a proportional response?
I'm sorry?
What is the virtue of a proportional response? Why is it good? They hit an airplane, so we hit a transmitter, right? That's a proportional response.
Sir, in the case of Pericles...
They hit a barracks, we hit two transmitters.
That's roughly it, yes, sir.
This is what we do. I mean, this is what we do.
Yes, sir, it's what we do. It's what we've always done.
Well, if it's what we do, if it's what we've always done, don't they know we're going to do it?
Sir, if you... turn your attention to Pericles 1.
I have turned my attention to Pericles 1. It's two ammo dumps, an abandoned railroad bridge, and a Syrian intelligence agency.
Those are four highly rated targets, sir.
But they know we're going to do that. They know we're going to do that. Those areas have been abandoned for 3 days now. We know that from the satellite, right? We have the intelligence.
Sir.
They did that, so we did this. It's the cost of doing business. It's been factored in, right?
Mr. President.
Am I right, or am I missing something here?
No, sir. You're right, sir.
Then I ask again, what is the virtue of a proportional response?
It isn't virtuous, Mr. President. It's all there is, sir.
It is not all there is.
Sir, Admiral Fitzwallace.
Excuse me, Leo. Pardon me, Mr. President. Just what else is there?
The disproportional response. Let the word ring forth from this time and this place, gentlemen. You kill an American, any American, we don't come back with a proportional response. We come back with total disaster.
Mr. President, are you suggesting we carpet bomb Damascus?
I am suggesting, General, that you and Admiral Fitzwallace and Secretary Hutchison and the rest of the national security team take the next 60 minutes and put together an American response scenario that doesn't make me think we are just docking somebody's damn allowance.
While I love West Wing, and I think Sorkin is a genius, I'm actually not convinced they got the definition of what proportionality in war is correct. Because proportionality in war is not that you killed five of my civilians, so now I get to kill five of your civilians. And if I kill six or seven, that's disproportionate.
Mm-hmm.
What proportionality is, legally, is I set for myself war aims of either, I don't know, creating deterrence or destroying my enemy. And based on those war aims, proportionality is considered. And what might be disproportionate for one war aim is completely proportionate for another.
And so it's two legal factors. One is the war aim legally justifiable? And then are the means that I'm going to use to get to that aim proportionate
right.
to the goal.
And once I've said that my aim is to completely destroy Hamas, mm-hmm. the room for maneuver in terms of proportionality is different to if I just said, I want to restore deterrence, mm-hmm. for example. So we're going to be speaking about a whole array of those things today. Matthew and Mike, as always, are going to take different positions. Who's starting? Mike, why don't we start with you?
Okay,
We're going to talk about humanitarian aid. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about civilian casualties, mm-hmm. collateral damage. Mm-hmm. And if you want to talk about the concept of proportionality, you're also welcome to.
Yeah, well, once the goal is to eliminate an entity like Hamas, I'm taking the position in this debate that there almost is nothing off the table in terms of proportionality, that by definition, it's going to rack up massive numbers of civilian casualties. And yes, if you can, in theory, do something to achieve that goal, to minimize that somewhat, I guess you can consider it, but not very long and very deeply, because you can't put the lives of your own soldiers at risk. And this is basically what happens in a war. When one side starts a war, and the goal of the war is to eliminate that force. And here, it even applies to state actors. If you look at World War II and the Allies, what they did to Germany in order to defeat the Nazis. To get to the Nazis, they had to go through German cities, Japanese cities. If you look at a more recent war, a 21st century war, the second Gulf Wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, what the Allied powers had to go through to get to take down Al-Qaeda or to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Now, whether overthrowing Saddam Hussein was a strategically smart goal or not isn't the issue. Once that goal was set and it was accepted by those allies, then what they did was they ran through Iraq, destroying it, including many civilian lives. And that's what war is. Now, again, I don't want to talk about whether the Bush administration was smart to invade Iraq.
Another podcast.
That's a different...
We'll relate it to Israel in some way, and then we'll do one on Iraq.
Yeah.
Iraq, good, bad.
Yeah. But here, I don't think anyone who's clear thinking considers the goal of eliminating Hamas to be off the table as a inappropriate war goal after October 7th. I think most Western observers think it's a perfectly reasonable goal. And the immediate snapback of, oh, well, you have to do it without civilian casualties is, forgive me, it's stupid. In other words, is it horrible that civilians are dying and suffering? Yes, it is. It is inevitable. Is it falling into the strategic trap that Hamas has laid because it wants us to kill thousands and thousands of Palestinian civilians because it knows that the world conversation about Israel is nonsensical and it'll get people angry at us? Yes. Are we handing them a public relations victory by doing it? Yes, we are. Do I feel bad for those children and those women? Of course. Of course. People. I've had students say to me, why should I feel bad? I said, because they're women and children. Because when a child suffers, I don't think we should harden our hearts. I think we should understand that the cost of what we have to do is not only on us, but on them. That's the situation Hamas has put us in. What's the next day's plan? If we decide, well, we can't topple Hamas because of the heavy civilian price. Okay, so Hamas continues to exist. They've stated their goal is to rebuild their capabilities to do October 7th again. Right. There's no way out of this without plowing down Hamas. And that means there's going to be enormous suffering. And will that lead to the Palestinian people no longer approving of or supporting organizations like Hamas? I don't know. If they don't, then they're going to continue to end up in this situation, a horrible situation. I am not happy that our 18 to 40 whatever year olds are out there causing all this misery. And it is misery. It's hard to listen to the reports of what's going on in these, you know, camps where they're living in tents and there isn't enough food and there isn't enough water and there's disease spreading. It's horrible. People who don't know what their future is, horrible, horrible, horrible. Well, yeah, that's what having Nazis as leaders brings upon Germany. That's what having militaristic Imperial Japan did to Japan. That's what having, you know, the Taliban allow Al-Qaeda to run in Afghanistan. It brings horrible things to Afghanistan and Japan and Germany and Gaza. That's what it is. Our job is to protect ourselves. And the idea that we then, while we're doing it, have to not only not hurt their civilians, but provide aid to their civilians, provide fuel to their civilians, which we know is going to be turned around and used against us, is nonsensical. And the fact that there are people in the world saying those things, well, yeah, there's people in the world saying we shouldn't exist. There are people saying Israel's committing genocide when there's 10 to 20,000 people dead in a tiny area with over 2 million people. And they're accusing us of genocide? So I understand that there's a political need to address those people in some countries and some, I understand that there's going to be an impact on that on us. But the main goal, the most basic goal of any government is to protect the lives and welfare of its citizens. And so once the gloves are off, the gloves are off and everything goes on the table. Limiting your goal means you're not going to win the war. And that's the worst possible consequence.
Great. Thank you, Mike. Mm-hmm. Matthew.
Wow. Okay. So I have a couple of things to say, partly in response and partly proactive in terms of this.
I hope it stays proportionate, Matt.
maybe not in time sense.
Or to whatever I did.
It won't be the same time, I'm sure, but okay. If that's how we're defining proportional. So I think one of the things to think about here is in terms of what you both mentioned in terms of the goals, right? What are the goals of the war? And it's interesting because when we mentioned what the goals are, so the destruction of Hamas, right? We do not want Hamas to do this again. I don't think there's anybody in their right mind living in this country who wants Hamas to have the capability to do this again. So the goal, I think, is agreed on, right?
Well, the goal isn't to prevent them from being able to do it again. The goal is to prevent them from existing as a functional entity.
In order that they cannot do it again.
But that makes a big difference.
I'm not sure that it does, but okay, we can come back to it afterwards if we want
to. If we cut off all their index fingers and leave them all alive, they can't fire rifles. Our goal is to kill, disrupt, take down their ability as an organization.
Degrade
them to the point that they no longer exist as a functional organization.
And if they had no hands and no ears and no tongues, then maybe they could, but fine. But in terms of the way that goal is achieved, again, I'm not disagreeing with you. The leadership of Hamas, the leadership of Gaza has brought terrible ruin upon the people there, upon the civilians. And that probably a topic for another debate is what constitutes a civilian there. That's probably a topic for another podcast. But I do think that for two major reasons, the way that that war is conducted or the way that that mission is conducted has to be carefully considered. I think the claims of genocide are also, I agree with you, ridiculous. If Israel wants to commit genocide, they would be committing a genocide, and they don't. So I think that claim is ridiculous. But I also think that as an army that is trying to do its best to limit civilian casualties, for whatever reason they're trying to do that, but I think we can all agree here in this room, I think we would all agree they're trying to limit those civilian casualties, there are other steps that also need to be taken, one of which, for example, we're talking about humanitarian aid. Yes, we know it's going to be used to some degree against Israel. We know that. We know it's going to get stolen by Hamas, some of it. We know that. But that doesn't stop the hundreds of thousands of women and children who have nothing to eat. And I think in good conscience, it's very hard as a moral imperative. We have to say, okay, listen, it sucks that Hamas are taking it. It sucks that it's going to be used against us. But we have a responsibility. If we're going to be knocking down most of the places where people are living and we're going to be using our forces against civilian infrastructure, which is being used by Hamas, we know why we're attacking it. At that point, we have to provide food and some sort of aid. And I think that's really important. I was listening to a podcast with Dr. Michael Walzer, who wrote this book about
Unholy. On Unholy.
Yes, and I've heard him somewhere else as well. So I think he's been doing the rounds recently. And he was talking about the way that war in an ethical is conducted ethically. And he was saying, look, you can justify collateral damage, you can justify those sorts of things, but to justify basically besieging an area and cutting off food and water to a civilian population, in his estimation, is not possible to justify. So if we go from that sense ethically, that's one thing. The second thing to think about maybe, and even if you say, I don't care about ethics, I don't care about that, fine. If we care about the practical goals of the war, let's say it's to destroy Hamas, right? Destroy, destroy, destroy. We saw what happened at the beginning of the ground campaign when Israel did turn off the water and did turn off the food supply. The whole world went absolutely ape. And that was even before they did it. It was like a discussion. Were they going to do it? The world went ape. And in order to have the maneuverability, the time and the thing to be able to complete this mission, we need to maintain some international favor, whether we like it or not, especially with the Americans. We know the Americans are providing munitions, providing a lot of diplomatic cover, but more, and their patience is running thin. We're recording this in a time when America's diplomatic cover or their diplomatic will is weakening, shall we say. It's causing some problems domestically for President Biden.
It's being reported to. Fine, it's causing domestic problems. And so often historians often show that these diplomatic spats between Israel and the Americans is the Americans have to create domestic political cover. And so they pretend. And so everybody's screaming in Israel about, oh, how can they pull their support back? Is really exactly playing into the leaders in America saying, see, my constituents, I can push back on Israel.
Yeah, yeah. I'm as cynical.
It's all part of the game.
Sure. I'm as cynical as you are when it comes to that. But I do think if we had said as a country, we are literally cutting off all food supplies, and we mustn't forget Israel does have, basically can have the ability to encircle Gaza and to cut all supplies off. If we said we're doing that and we went ahead with that, that's a very different story. Now, we may not, the way that the international community sees us and we see all these activists who are saying, screaming genocide, you might say, well, they're screaming genocide. We're not committing genocide, so screw it. We might as well just do whatever we want if they don't care anyway about the measures that we're taking to protect civilian lives. But I still think it's important, A, for our own sense of well-being, ethical well-being, and secondly, for our own diplomatic needs to continue to provide aid to the people that need it.
There are two really fascinating perspectives. A general question, actually. So we're recording this in mid-February, where the big talk at the moment is about Israel potentially carrying out a ground maneuver in Rafah in the south. There's certainly military logic for it. There's, I think, four Hamas battalions there. It could well be where the leadership is. It could well be where hostages are. There's what's called a Philadelphia corridor between Egypt and Gaza, where a lot of smuggling's gone on, almost certainly lots of tunnels there. At the same time, there's well over a million, I was going to say 1.3 million, but well over a million civilians actually who have fled from northern and central Gaza because Israel told them to flee south. The Americans, again, unclear whether to what extent it's posturing or not. Dufgran, on that aspect, I think Biden saying, don't move in Rafah until you've got a plan to move the civilian population is probably not posturing, but again, it's just an opinion. Based on what both of you have said, what do you think about a potential Israeli military maneuver in Rafah that, again, has the military logic, but also has a hell of a lot of Palestinian civilians? Mike, how do you kind of balance the different considerations that you've been talking about?
If I was in the civilian political leadership, I would turn to my generals and I would say, what's it going to take down Hamas? How much of that can we do? If we give in to this American demand or that American demand, how much do we not have to listen? How much do we have to? If they, whatever they tell me, we can do both, because America is an ally, I will do both. Where we can't, I'm going to contact the Americans and say, look, if we do it that way, Hamas gets away. We're going to miss saving hostages. And so we're not willing to do either of those things. We'll do this and this and this to satisfy you politically. After that, we have to achieve our goals here. Anything that gets in the way of our goal. So if it doesn't take away from our goal, then we can do whatever, you know, Matt's saying we have to do these things for political, fine. I'm sure there are things we can do to make it look like we're satisfying our allies. But if you're asking me, and by the way, even morally, if you want to give some people time to get out of the way because they're refugees hiding in Rafah, I don't even know what that means. There's a million people hiding in Rafah. So if they move to Rafah, so move somewhere else. I don't understand what's the holdup there or why that's so incredibly difficult. But just like you said, they told them to leave the north. They left the north. Okay, now move over towards Khan Yunis and stay closer to there or whatever the logistics are. So then just do that. And then go in, kill whoever's left of the leadership, kill who's ever left of the fight. Those, you know, if half of their military still exists in Rafah, then it's the job to kill half the military.
Matthew?
Okay, so again, I agree with Mike about the goals, right? The goal, and if the goal is to destroy Hamas and the goal is to see this through to the end, then it has to be seen through to the end. And I agree with what you were saying, Caleb, that there are clearly important military reasons to do this, right? The question becomes, of course, how do you go about it? And I think I'm not entirely sure I disagree with you, Mike, that there must be a way to solve this issue. Now, when, again, this Biden posturing, when they were talking about how are you going to move 1 million people? Well, they moved in the first place, exactly as you said, so they could move back again.
Well, they might not be able to move back. There's not really back. There's somewhere, there's another area near the sea that's been talked about.
For those people. But I think that what has to be taken into consideration, again, indeed, is that there is a place for them to go, and that when they get there, there is some sort of supplies given to them. Because if they just are told, okay, fine, the Israeli army is coming in now, that's not a way to, that's not going to achieve some of the non-military goals, right? Because we're going to end up with basically hundreds of thousands of massacred Palestinians, not intentionally, of course, but if you are in the middle of a battlefield, that is what will happen. And I don't think anybody wants that to happen. Even on the Israel side, I don't think most people do not want there to be a civilian massacre.
So I'm okay with that as long as Israel's not responsible to providing that aid to those Palestinians. If it allows international organizations, UN organizations, Red Cross organizations.
You mean like UNRWA?
Well, UNRWA no longer has the right. There are plenty of UN organizations.
Not even a topic for another podcast. I'm not even sure there's two views on UNRWA.
There isn't. It has to be shut down. And there are plenty of other organizations that could take over the humanitarian aspects. So if they, but then they have to be held accountable for any slice of bread that ends up out of civilian hands. And I actually don't think it's that hard, Matt, to figure out who the civilians are. It's the non-combatants. If there are militants hiding among the civilians, well, that's a militant pretending to be a civilian. But essentially, anyone who's not a... I don't like when people bring up, they go, no one in Gaza is innocent, everyone's a target. I don't understand that. There's no legal discussion about whether people in war are innocent or guilty. That's a legal term. The question is, are they combatants or non-combatants? And all the non-combatants... go ahead, go to that new thing by the water, whatever it is, have a nice beach day, put up your, I know it's the winter, so, and I don't want to be flippant about civilians in danger, but international aid organizations have to be held accountable for two things. Number one, are these supplies getting to the intended population? If not, why not? And how are you going to solve that problem? Because that's not our job. Number two, are Israeli hostage prisoners being treated as non-combatant civilians and getting the aid due to them? If not, why not? And what are you going to do about it? So I have no problem with non-combatants receiving aid. I think it's appalling that only one side, I know the numbers are greater on the Palestinian side. That's true. And that requires more logistical effort. But why they're, but demanding international, the Red Cross has to get in to see those prisoners and take care of them and check on their welfare.
Agreed.
Make sure they're having food, make sure they're not being raped. Now, It's not going to happen because Hamas isn't going to deal with the Red Cross. So that has to be called out. That has to be called
out. It's so interesting because that's that sense of proportionality or disproportional. Oh, because there's more of them, they should be treated better, right? That's basically what you're saying. But we still have...
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that whole issue, when Kalev earlier addressed how proportionality is often discussed, you know, if they come at you with a knife, you have to fight them with a knife. You can't use your gun, right? To paraphrase Sean Connery, they bring a knife, you bring a gun. They put one of yours in the hospital, you put one of theirs in the morgue. That's the Chicago way, right? From the Untouchables. But obviously, you don't, if, you know, I'm 6'3", 250 pounds, I'm a big guy. If a 5 foot tall person who's all lanky and starts hitting me and pulls out a knife, do I have to say, well, I better shrink down to 5 feet tall? I'll go on my knees, I guess, so that I... It is bullying if a big person picks on a small person. But what happens when the weak small person attacks the big person? Does the big person have to say, well,
I mean, that wasn't the point I was trying to get across. What I was trying to say is this idea of why the Israeli prisoner hostages are not being given the same concern.
I don't think it's just because there's millions of Palestinians, 2 million Palestinians in Gaza who are suffering, and there's 100 Israelis in prison. I don't think that's the reason. I think it's because one's Israeli.
Right. I agree with you.
And one's Arab.
But the optics of it looks different, right? It does look different.
That's fine. But the burden on international organizations has to be proportionate to each individual.
Agreed.
It makes absolutely no difference to me. Right. These things are bizarre.
Okay. So I just want, I think I just have one more thing to say about this is, and as a forum of educators, which is effective, which is what we are, I've been having these conversations in my classes with my students about what they think is where the levels are, where they think the right conduct is, where they think conduct is appropriate, inappropriate, in relation to humanitarian aid, in relation to collateral damage, what kind of collateral damage, what sort of actions against combatants, non-combatants, against how to, what the role of the hostages plays in all of this. And it's really interesting to see how young adults, right, they're 18, 19, 20, how they're grappling with this. And there's a difference between those who are serving, who are here either for like their gap year and they're studying in Israel, and it's sort of like a theoretical conversation, and then talking about it with young Israelis who I know and having the conversation with them and seeing where the differences are between sort of the diaspora attitude and the Israel attitude, and seeing where the similarities are and where they overlap. And
Can you say more? I think that's really interesting. How would a typical, in inverted commas, Israeli versus a typical American who's on their gap year relate to these things based on your, it's all anecdotal.
Yeah, yeah,
but
it's totally anecdotal. So for the Israelis, it's very much like we have to go and we have to finish the job. And those who are in the army are like, I'm going back to finish the job. Those who are getting ready to go in the army, so I can't wait to go in and do my bit to work on this. There's a very increased, I've noticed a very increased level of motivation in the kids that I'm speaking to, like, you know, friends of mine, their children, and you know.
So that doesn't contradict the importance, finishing the job, but importance of protecting civilians,
absolutely,
et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
But, as in, it doesn't contradict that.
No, I don't think so. But also in terms of protect, they want to protect their civilians here, right? And by doing that, the way to do that is to go join the army and to take an active role. And amongst the American yeshiva kids, or the ones I'm interacting with, they're much more sort of gung-ho about do whatever it takes to finish the mission. If that means cutting off aid, if that means dropping big bombs, do it. And it's just interesting to see that, because they're coming from a country where their government, whether it's posturing or not, is at least publicly saying we shouldn't be doing those things. But they've now got a new sense of what they think is the right thing to do, which is different from their government. And in the Israel side, it's more like, okay, we have to protect our country and do what's right to make sure our country is safe. It's
funny, Matthew, because I thought I'd just add, because there's another group, which is the non-yeshiva American students who are here.
Who I also interact with.
Yes, and amongst them, it's probably closer to it's Biden leftwards often.
Very often, but in this particular case, I think some of them were really traumatized by being here on October 7th. And seeing what's happened since, and they've gone to visit Hostage Square in Tel Aviv, and they've been sitting in shelters, like in the bomb shelters.
There are groups going down to the kibbutzim in the south to look at.
And they've really been traumatized by that. And it's interesting because in that regard, they're moving further away from Biden than you would have expected.
Meaning
that they're more sort of
closer to an Israeli position.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
More than
you
would have expected.
Well, that's why I think in all of these discussions, and when I address students in the early weeks, and you know, well, what I said, two things are going to happen. First of all, this is going to take a while. Second of all, we're going to lose soldiers. And it doesn't feel better to lose a soldier than it does to lose civilians. And as traumatized we are losing civilians, every soldier that falls is going to be incredibly painful. So steel your heart for that. And there's going to be massive collateral damage. And it's going to feel bad, and steel yourself for that. Because there's the feelings. And then there's the moral logic of the need to win. And once that moral logic is settled, then the feelings have to be addressed, validated, and dealt with, because because that's the simple reality we live in. That's the world today.
That also reminds me of another West Wing episode about kind of clear-sighted leadership.
I was telling Josh Lyman about a friend who just got his pilot's license. He told me the most remarkable thing. He said a new pilot will fly into cloud cover. There'll be no visibility. And they'll check their gauges. They'll look at the artificial horizon. It'll show them level. But they won't trust it. So they'll make an adjustment. And then another and another. He said the number of new pilots who fly out of clouds completely upside down would knock you out. My office will make arrangements for me to endorse you in the morning. You keep your eyes on the horizon, Mr. President.
Maybe we should do a special episode dedicated to the West Wing.
We absolutely should. Two voices. Should it be watched after Sorkin, or should one have stopped when Sorkin left? Two voices. Anyway, gentlemen, thank you very, very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you for listening. We look forward to being with you next time.
Thanks, fellas. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Israel Conversation by the Masa Leadership and Impact Center. In everything we do, we hope to connect our fellows to Israel as home, that our Masa fellows will feel at home in Israel and understand more about Israel in all of its diversity. We connect our fellows to Jewish peoplehood, to feel an affinity for Judaism and a sense of belonging to the Jewish people, and the connection is active and meaningful in their lives. And finally, personal development. And in the case of this podcast, our goal is that you'll be able to use the tools and learning for reflection and future development in conversations about Israel and Judaism. If this episode is meaningful to you, please subscribe and share with somebody that you think it will be meaningful to.